I was very fond of Kenneth Horne. He had a sense of humour that appealed to me. So it's particularly pleasant for me to be somewhere where he was. Serendipity is also functioning in the enormously erudite reading of poetry by our esteemed chairman, because he wasn't to know that some of the demonstrations I was planning to give tonight will be in mono and out of the left channel. But perhaps the greatest serendipitous event of tonight takes a bit more explaining. I've always taken the view that if you can't explain something, you don't know what you're talking about. I remember that the Nobel laureate Richard Feynman once withdrew a theory he had about quantum mechanics. And his colleague said, well, why? He said, well, because I couldn't explain it to a bunch of undergraduates. So he said, it must be wrong because I couldn't explain it. I think that's absolutely correct thinking. And you have to have a combination of thinking about your topic and also trying to explain it to others. Because if you can't explain what you're saying, if you can't withstand critical questioning, what you're saying may be nonsense. So I welcome questions. I welcome abuse. I welcome criticism. I welcome people saying that can't be true. Because by and large, over the years, I've been able to defend what I've been able to say. And therefore, I become a survivor. If you can withstand criticism, what you have to say becomes stronger. And that's how science works. So, many years ago, I was a training manager, because I've been teaching stuff for as long as I can remember, because it's a good way of learning. And I used to be, one of my instructors used to come into my office without warning. It was a bit like Cato to Peter Sellers, you know, he'd just arrive and attack me intellectually. He'd burst into the office and say, John, what's the answer to blah, 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 blah. And I'd say, well, if you think about it, it's got to be, you know, something like this. Oh, yeah, and he'd go away. And then a few weeks later or days later, he'd burst into my office again and say, John, what's the... And I go through the same procedure. But, you know, you got to think about it. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. And then one day he burst into my office and he didn't ask a question. I said, what? He said, you're strange, he said, because every time I come in here, you answer my questions. He said, how do you know all this stuff? He said, like, you know, it's like you're my hero. He said, do you have heroes? And I said, yes, I do. And it's enormously serendipitous that tonight one of my heroes is here, Siegfried. Thank you. We've all got to have heroes. We've all got to have people where what they say means something to us, where what they say resonates with us. And if there's one person on this planet that for a long, long time has said stuff that has resonated with me, it's Siegfried. So it's wonderful that you could be here. And I hope not to let you down. It's also quite good to be in a fire station of a kind. You know, I've had a burning desire to speak at places like this, and I'm hoping that what I say won't cause too many people to be put out.
John.
One little safety message is if anyone does discover a fire, would they please notify any ember of the staff? And if you're really fed up with me, you can tell me to go to blazes. Anyway, that's the fire jokes. But you've been warned, there are others. I did actually make some notes earlier, but I'm probably not going to adhere to them. It's a long-standing tradition that I never adhere to the notes that I make. Tradition, of course, is an alternative to thinking. and therefore it's right up there with prejudice. And the loudspeaker epitomizes that. The legacy loudspeaker today doesn't really have very much going for it. You can listen to a bunch of loudspeakers that all have the same specification, and they all sound different. And you go, huh. And of course, the immediate conclusion has to be the specifications are inadequate. You can always tell, listening through a doorway, that the sound coming through that door is coming from a loudspeaker. Why? Because it's inadequate. I think speaker design is a bit like culture. The art of culture is not what you do, it's what you don't do. The art of ethics is what you don't do. You don't shake hands with Jerry Adams. You don't read the News of the World. The art of loudspeaker design is what you don't do. You make a big list. You put it on the office wall. Big list of all the things that you can't do because you know it doesn't work. You can't use passive crossovers because they don't work. You can't use ports and resonance because it doesn't work. And so on, and so on, and so on. And if at the end of all these things you can't do, there's anything left, guess what? That's what you do. It's put around by mythologists, journalists, and other creatures of limited intellect that the human ear is fantastically sensitive and complicated and amazing, and that it can hear all kinds of stuff. It can't. The human ear is a primitive device. As transducers go, it's bloody terrible. Would you design a microphone like that? You know, what microphone designer in his right mind would put a mechanical leverage system between the diaphragm and the transducer? What microphone designer in his right mind would use a liquid in the transducer? Come on, you know, this is a very approximate device. And the only reason it works at all is what it's connected to, which is a brain. Well, in some cases. In order to understand loudspeakers, in order to make a loudspeaker that's anything decent, you have to understand this. And this. Because the fact that there's two of them is crucial. Even though I shall be demonstrating in mono, the fact that you can listen to something in mono still requires both ears. Much of what goes on in your listening system is not these crummy transducers which serve alternate duty for hanging spectacles. It's in the brain. That's where the magic lies. If you fit a microphone somewhere, you're usually disappointed with the sound it picks up because the microphone doesn't have a brain. The microphone doesn't know what it's listening to. It doesn't know what direction to listen in. If I want to listen to something Siegfried's saying while everybody else is rabbiting, I can do that. I have this marvelous principle within me called attentional selectivity, also known as the cocktail party effect. I'll drink to that. I can use the time of arrival of sounds at my two ears as a phased array and concentrate on listening in a particular direction, which a microphone can't do. It's dumb. It doesn't have a brain. This is why when we record, we have to mess around with the acoustics of the place in which we are recording, because our microphones are thick. We aren't. We don't hear like microphones. Since you've been in this room, subconsciously, you've measured the acoustic in here. And if you were talking to somebody out there earlier on, you will have subconsciously measured the acoustic out there. So that when you're talking to your friend out there, and when they come in here, they don't sound any different. And yet the acoustic environment in this room and in that room are different. So what's going on? The answer is that Homo so-called sapiens, which again is a subject of debate, has evolved to live in reverberant surroundings. The hearing mechanism is not for entertainment purposes. We are the survivors. We are the end of a brutal process of evolution where the inadequate didn't make it. They got eaten. The hearing mechanism made it possible to find food, to avoid being eaten. The hearing mechanism is a survival tool which evolved within all of us. It's not for listening to MP3. Not that I would listen to MP3 anyway. It's a compression for the deaf. So we've got this amazing mechanism within us that's evolved over millennia that allows us to hear in reverberant surroundings. And Mr. Haas had something to say about that, and I don't need to repeat what he said. But basically, if you are in a reverberant surrounding, you attribute the sound to be coming from the first version, because that's the shortest distance. If he says something to me, sound directly from him has come the shortest distance, it's got to get here first. If the sound bounces off the wall over there, off Her Majesty, and then comes to me, it takes longer. Might be more royal, but it's later. And I attribute the direction from the first one. So, we all know this. My question is, why the hell don't loudspeaker designers know it? You talk to any acoustician, you say, how much of the sound reaching somebody in the average room is direct and how much is reverberant? They say, well, that's obvious, it's all reverberant. I say, yes. You talk to a loudspeaker designer, and I say, what do you think about reverberant sound? Oh, it's terrible, you've got to absorb it. Why do we spend our lives fitting damping material on walls to soak up reverberation from loudspeakers when we don't everywhere else? Why do we go into these dark control rooms that have the oppressive atmosphere of being in some sort of a prison when in the rest of our lives we don't live there? Why do we mix music in these places when nobody listens to it under those conditions? Stupid. The trouble is with saying that things are stupid is that you can feel very, very lonely. I feel sometimes like the child who pointed out that the emperor wasn't actually wearing anything, which is something that Siegfried raised earlier. Kindred spirits, yes?
Yes.
Why is it? Why do we do these stupid things? Why don't we make loudspeakers that work in real rooms? Floyd Toole put it very succinctly in presentations he's been making recently. He's another hero, by the way. He said, if the sound from a loudspeaker hitting some reflective surface in a room is of sufficient quality, he said, let it reflect. I don't have any beliefs. I know that if you have to absorb sound from a loudspeaker that isn't satisfactory, it's simply proof that the loudspeaker is no good. And therefore, what I hold is that if a loudspeaker is going to radiate sound, the quality of that sound should be the same in every direction in which the sound is emitted. Traditionally, loudspeakers are measured on axis. Why the hell should a loudspeaker have an axis? What musical instrument do you know that's got an axis? What person do you know who speaks with an axis? What room do you know that's got an axis? Why the hell are we measuring loudspeakers like that? Because it's easy. You ask somebody what the most important parameter of a loudspeaker is, they'll say, oh yeah, that's easy, that's the frequency response. The frequency response of the human ear is complete crap. Not only is it complete crap, it's variable crap. It changes with the level, changes with the amount of coffee you've drunk, and critical bandwidth changes tremendously with the amount of alcohol you've consumed. Frequency response of human hearing is rubbish. I maintain that frequency response testing of loudspeakers is done because it's easy. You just stick a microphone in front of it, sweep some sound waves through it, and see what happens. Sound waves are interesting. From an information theory standpoint, a sound wave is very interesting because it has no bandwidth. Therefore, it doesn't transmit any information at all. So why are we testing loudspeakers that are supposed to convey information with a signal that doesn't contain any information? You can test a loudspeaker with sound waves till you're blue in the face and it can still be rubbish. Because the time it takes for those sound waves to go through it might not all be the same. What is probably more important in a loudspeaker is the time it takes for sounds to come out. Because our hearing works in the time domain. It doesn't work in the frequency domain, it works in the time domain. That's how we can tell where a sound came from. Remember, hearing is a survival tool. We want to know where that sound is coming from and how big it is. Because if it's small and we can reach it, it might form a meal. If it's large and it can reach us, we might be its meal. So, human hearing works on time. It works on time of arrival at ear A, ear B. And if there's a difference in time, then guess what? The sound's not on axis. Because our hearing doesn't have an axis. Our hearing is 360. We can tell whether stuff is behind us, in front of us. And from experience, we can even tell whether sound is above or below. That's difficult with laterally spaced ears. There's no physics there. But experience tells you that birds typically don't sing when they're on the ground. It draws attention to them. They sing in the trees. So you hear a bird singing, you go, yeah, it's up there. Typically, aeroplanes don't fly on the ground. It causes a lot of paperwork. So if we hear a sound that might be up or down, we have a pretty damn shrewd guess about where the sound's coming from. And we're usually right. One of the strangest things that happened to me was I was up a Welsh mountain and the Royal Air Force decided to fly by, below me. Aeroplanes flying below you sound bloody strange. And I wasn't expecting that. And again, it's an education. So, if we are trying to reproduce sound, in other words, to give some sort of a confidence trick coming out of the box that's going to be more plausible than any other confidence trick, what are the criteria? Well, sure, the frequency response has got to be reasonable, but it doesn't have to be brilliant. But there are two neglected criteria in loudspeakers. Legacy loudspeakers simply do not meet. One of these is directivity. As I said before, if the sound coming out of a speaker comes out in a certain direction, it ought really to have the same quality as it does in any other direction. Because otherwise it's not correctly exciting the reverberation of the room. And it will sound rubbish.
Lost the sound.
That would be a battery.
Finger trouble, battery trouble.
Is the switch on? It's still on.
I am a victim of a dead battery.
And my batteries are in my room. Anyone got a couple of AAs?
Is that Alcoholics Anonymous?
It's my cue to get a cup. I have the bladder from hell.
Oh, that's brought me to a halt, isn't it?
It's very smart for me to buy the batteries, but less smart for me not to bring them here.
She's gone red on me big time. Just talk among yourselves for a while.
What's curious is the fact that it's the Energizer Bunny in the United States and the Duracell Bunny here.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think of something to say. One? No? Why is that not?
Went very suddenly.
Anybody here know anything about sound?
Not a thing. No.
One.
No, it isn't. One. One. Zero. Where was I? I've lost my train.
You weren't on a train.
Activity.
You weren't on a train.
No, you were up a Welsh mountain.
I was up a Welsh mountain listening to aeroplanes. Yes. What the hell was I doing now?
Do you hold the microphone a little closer? It's background noise is a bit higher at the back.
I want to hold it closer. Yes, then I'll get bass tip up.
And
all of my plosives will be exaggerated.
Okay, well, we could turn you up instead.
You're a hero.
I can also turn it up.
Oh, okay, it's better.
He's got the technology. He could basically cue him down as well if he got close.
I was talking about directivity, I think.
Yes.
The reason you can always tell that a legacy loudspeaker is operating in another room is that what comes out of the door is rubbish. Because a legacy loudspeaker can only produce half-decent sound in one direction. And if you're not in that direction, it's tough. However, if you have a loudspeaker that produce half-decent sound in all directions, you will find that that problem no longer exists. You'll find that you cannot tell whether the sound coming through the door of another room is from an original sound source or from a loudspeaker. Some years ago, when my younger son was still living with me, and he, by the way, is a very accomplished pianist, one day someone came to the door. And standing at the front door, they said, "Oh, is Matthew here?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, who's playing the piano?" I said, "It's the loudspeakers." I said, "What?" sure enough, I was playing piano music through an ancestor of these things. Loudspeakers that properly excite the reverberation in the room and produce the same quality of sound in all horizontal directions. And when you do that, you cannot tell whether the sound is coming from a loudspeaker or from an original source. A further demonstration of that was at the Tate Modern in London, which is a former power station. I got a phone call one day, you know something about loudspeakers? I said, well, it's been alleged. They said, we've got a problem. I said, what? They said, well, we've got this exhibition of Romanian sculpture.
Brancusi.
Brancusi, yeah. And what we wanted to do was that people could walk around looking at these works of art, listening to piano music and listening to a soprano singing. So I said, that sounds good. What's the problem? He said, the insurance company won't let us put a piano in the same room as these sculptures. I said, what, pianos explode that often? He said, yeah, you don't know how dangerous pianos are. He said, can you relay the sound of a piano and a soprano into the exhibition hall? So I said, probably. So we did. And the exhibition hall and the hall where the musicians were was separated by a room which must have been about the length of this one, but not as wide, with doors at both ends. And I adjusted the knobs until the sound coming into this intermediate room from the real musicians was at the same level as the sound coming in from the loudspeakers in the exhibition. You stood in the middle, you could not tell where the sound was coming from and which was the original. Such was the impact of this that I was told it by the security men. Security men are not noted for their qualifications in electroacoustics. But a large bloke in a big black uniform came up to me and he said, how the hell do you do that? So I said, well, it's got something to do with the way the loudspeakers work. I said, because they produce sound in all directions, it comes through the doorway, just like the people singing. Oh, he said, that makes sense. So already the security man at the Tate Modern is way ahead of most traditional loudspeaker designers. Miles ahead. Because he understood. And he didn't argue. And one of the problems with saying stuff like this is that it's not acceptable. You know, I got told at one conference when I said something like this, this guy came up to me afterwards. He said, I got all your books. I said, yeah. He said, they're wonderful. I said, yeah. He said, but on this occasion, I've got to disagree with you. I said, why? Well, what you're saying can't be right. So I said, well, what makes you think that what I'm saying about loudspeakers is any different to what I said about digital audio or about digital video or about MPEG or about helicopters? Why should I have deliberately fucked up my presentation today? But it can't be right. I said, well, you know, laws of physics haven't changed. So the reason it can't be right is because it's not suitable for your purposes. And sure enough, he worked for a loudspeaker manufacturer. Well, I had to be wrong to suit his purposes. When you build loudspeakers that work properly, you become a pariah. You get hate mail from traditional speaker manufacturers. A good friend of mine, who is not an audio engineer, he's a gifted cinematographer, but he owns a pair of these. He said to me one day, he said, you know, John, he said, you're not going to get a traditional loudspeaker manufacturer to build those. So I said, why? He said, because if they do, they're going to have to explain why the rest of their product line is shit. He's right. Now, directivity is only one part of the problem. There are three problems with loudspeakers. One of them is directivity. One of them is frequency response. One of them is the time domain. We are very sensitive to the time domain. That's how we judge where the sound is coming from. That's how we judge how big the sound source is. You know, if you record a cannon being fired, you get a step and an exponential decay. If you record a pistol being fired, you get a step and a shorter exponential decay, because it's smaller. That's physics. If you try to reproduce those for a loudspeaker, you get a waveform looking like a dog's dinner. Because traditionally loudspeakers cannot reproduce transients. One of the reasons is that they use suboptimal crossover networks. They use this horrible concatenation of inductors and capacitors that cannot produce a pair of waveforms that sum to the original. I would argue that a crossover should divide the frequency domain into two pieces in such a way that were you to add the signals back together, you should get the original. 99.9% of loudspeakers cannot do that because it's not possible with a passive crossover. A passive crossover cannot subtract. The only way you can actually correctly perform the crossover function is with subtraction. So you can produce this band of signals and subtract it from the input and get that band of signals. One for the HF, one for the LF. And of course, by definition, if you do that, when you add them back together, you get the original signal. All passive crossovers cannot do that. Therefore, you cannot recreate the input waveform. So I thought, well, that's stupid. What we're listening for in sound is the waveform. We use the waveform to judge where things are and how big they are. You need to reproduce the waveform. Therefore, the loudspeaker must have an accurate mathematical crossover which produces a set of signals that add back to the original QED. So I thought, okay, that sounds difficult, but not impossible. It was easier than I thought. The next problem is that traditionally, which doesn't require thought, loudspeakers use resonance. They use resonance to save money. Resonant loudspeakers are cheaper for the same SPL. But if you're only interested in SPL and not in the waveform, then fine. But if you're interested in the time domain, you'll find that no resonant speaker technology can reproduce the input waveform. Because any time you use resonance, you've got a lag before the thing gets going after the input. And then you've got a hangover when it keeps going after the input's gone away. It's not acceptable. Isn't it funny that when people design audio amplifiers, they test them with square waves? Why do they do that? Because a square wave has got a phase-coherent set of sine waves embedded in it, according to Monsieur Fourier. If an amplifier can reproduce a square wave, it must be phase linear. The time taken for every frequency to pass through it must be the same. And therefore that must be true for any waveform, including audio. You know, I don't listen to square waves, it's not rewarding. But it's a good test. So I argued that a loudspeaker should be able to reproduce a square wave. And it can. If that's your criterion. If that's the specification you set yourself, that's what I have to achieve to make this work. Okay, just do it. So what we've got here is probably the third generation of loudspeakers I've been playing with over the years. Excuse me. For reasons that Siegfried has explained earlier today, loudspeakers need to reproduce the same sound quality in all directions. That's one of the criteria for these speakers. They reproduce the same quality 360. For my criteria, these speakers can reproduce acoustic square waves. You can put a microphone here, connect it to an oscilloscope, put a square wave in, and get an acoustic square wave out. So these loudspeakers are linear phase. The forerunners of these loudspeakers have been tested in the anechoic chambers of Genelec in Finland. A lot of people think Hilpo Martikainen is my brother because we both got white beards. Genelec's chief engineer was unable to tell me the crossover frequency of my speaker. Because I would argue if the crossover is any good, you can't hear it. I then repeated the trick at Bang & Olufsen in Struer. Bang & Olufsen's anechoic chamber was unable to tell me the crossover frequency of the speakers. For 15 odd years now, I've been offering a bottle of scotch to anybody who could tell me the crossover frequency.
Single malt.
Well, it's not relevant. I haven't brought the bottle. Because nobody's going to tell me. By definition, you can't tell. Because what comes out is the input waveform. Crossover? Not crossover. If you're going to use more than one drive unit in a loudspeaker, and you all know why you have to, it then follows that when you have a pair of drive units in a speaker, the acoustic summing of the sound from those two drive units has to be so, and the acoustic subtraction in the crossover has to be the inverse of so. If you don't do that, you can hear the crossover. So this loudspeaker contains two crossovers. It's got an electronic one up in the lid here, which mathematically subtracts stuff from other stuff and produces pairs of signals. But it's also got an acoustic inverse crossover somewhere in here, where the sound from one drive unit is properly added to the sound from another drive unit in time coherence, so that what's produced is the original waveform. So, enough of this nonsense, and perhaps I should demonstrate some sounds which emphasize these characteristics the most, which of course is percussion. Most loudspeakers can reproduce what we call statistically stationary sound fairly well. But, of course, there's no information in that. All of the information in sound is in transients. So I found a recording of a band that doesn't make any sustained sounds. This is a percussion group that only makes transients. So let's play that. You'll appreciate that I'm using some really primitive equipment here. It's known as a compact disc. Some of you may remember those. And this particular compact disc was recorded using microphones that were tested for phase linearity by the transducers that are in this loudspeaker. There's no point in trying to demonstrate a linear phase loudspeaker if you don't have a linear phase microphone. So, anyway, enough of this. Let me see if this thing works and see what it sounds like. It goes on a bit like that. What's interesting about omnidirectional loudspeakers is that the reverberant sound is more important than the direct sound. What's also, as I said earlier, what's serendipitous is that Keith raised the topic of mono. I'm going to unplug a speaker, the right one, or the wrong one, depending on who you look at. Remember these XLR connectors? It's specification for an XLR connector is that it should be able to tow an outside broadcast vehicle without unlatching. It met that specification. So now we've got mono. And what I'm going to do is to play something in mono. And I'm going to stand in front of the speaker. And you can judge what effect it has on the sound. And then I'm going to put something behind the speaker. And you can tell me what effect it has on the sound. Another aspect of this demo is that it contains some whistling. And traditionally, legacy loudspeakers make a complete pig's ear of whistling, so you can tell that it's a loudspeaker. So let's try and do all of those things at once. This is Livingston Taylor, brother of James Taylor.
Isn't she wonderful? Isn't she precious? Less than 1 minute, I never thought through love we'd be making one as lovely as she.
You get it?
Isn't she lovely, made from love? Isn't she pretty? Truly the angel's best. Boy, I'm so happy. We have lived ever blessed. I can't believe what God's done. Through us, he's given life. Isn't she lovely?
Just to show that I wasn't cheating. Obstructing the on-axis sound of a legacy speaker has less effect in obstructing the reverberant sound, because reverberant sound in a real room is dominant. That's why it's so important that sound in all directions coming out of the speaker should be as good as sound in any direction. So if you can't revolve a loudspeaker while you're listening to it, it's probably no good. It's part of the spec for this. You know, you cross out all the things that you can't do. If there's anything left, that's what you have to do. That's what I did. The omnidirectional loudspeaker, because it excites the room well, makes a very good job of mono. Thank you, Keith. One of the advantages of standing up here is that you all have to shut up and listen, and I can say what I like. I can pretty much do what I like within the tolerances of being invited back. And that includes playing what the hell I like. So, what I'd like to play for you is some old stuff dating from before Mono. Well, before Syria, sorry. And as we've got only one speaker connected, then let's play something really old and see if it still stands up.
Love letter straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart.
That microphone technology has been in advance of loudspeaker technology for many decades. 1962, Getty Lester. That was one of the first recordings that got my attention. I used to come home from school, and Mummy had a Philips radio in the kitchen with a Magic Eye tuning device. Really magical green thing that did this, and I thought that was fantastic, and stuff came out of this radio. Most of it went straight on my head, and one day I came home and Katy Lester was playing on the radio, and I just sort of stopped, sort of paralysed. I thought, oh, that's different. So that's why I'm playing that one tonight. One of the great things about being older is that you've had more time to practice not giving a shit. And so you can subject people to your prejudices with less self-consciousness. This is another recording that was mixed in Meyer by one of my heroes, Phil Spector. This was designed to be heard in mono on jukeboxes and radios. This was before stereo. And I think what's really interesting about this recording is the way that the vocal stands out. Even though all the sound is coming from one place, somehow the way the mix is done enables the vocalist to stand out above all the other stuff that's going on. And of course, Phil Spector specialised in lots of stuff going on. He didn't call it the wall of sound for nothing. So, let's give it a try. It's not bad for 1964. Of course, I was growing up at that time and very influenced by my sonic environment. And that was the time of the pirate radio stations, which were dotted around the coast of England and the Netherlands and various other places, which were what we now call disruptive technology. Today we're getting used to disruptive technology. In fact, we're even listening to some. But back then the term wasn't in widespread use. But the pirate radio stations were filling a requirement which state-owned broadcasters were not meeting. The fact that music had changed, the fact that listening tastes had changed, the fact that young people actually wanted to say in what was being broadcast. Well, young people should be seen and not heard. And the pirate radio stations had a big part in changing that. And being interested in electronics from an early age meant that I had a radio antenna running the length of my parents' back garden, which meant that I could pick up every pirate radio station on the planet. And I did. I was probably the only person in East Yorkshire who knew who Kenny Everett was, because he began his career on a pirate radio station before he became famous on television, doing everything in the best possible taste. That's something I've never tried to emulate. And of course, when you do something disruptive, as Isaac Newton would have predicted, there's a reaction. Because the reaction from the British government was to stop it. Bounders. What do they think they're doing? Who do they think they are? So, of course, these radio stations were put off the air. So the next track I'm going to play you is... It's actually in stereo, because that had come to East Yorkshire by this time. You know, I got cars there now. So I'm going to connect the other speaker. Like that. So when Radio Caroline closed down forever, this is the last track that they played before the RF went.
Thank you.
Isn't it interesting how most of the musicians I've played so far are black? It kind of ties in with what I said about prejudice being alternative to thinking. Here's another. This is Jackie Wilson, an underprivileged individual who began life as a boxer and then discovered that he could sing and then some. A lucky life in many respects. I'm lucky to be here, but the luck started earlier. I was unable to get a job in the audio industry when I graduated with a master's degree in sound and vibration Institute of Sound and Vibration Research, because there weren't any. Oh. The British audio industry was imploding. I think the British motor industry copied it a few years later. So I ended up working for a computer company, simply because in the ISVR we had a PDP-11, which we used to analyse sounds. And I got to know the people from digital. And I spent many happy years in the computer industry, thinking, I'm an audio engineer, what am I doing here? And I finally went back to the audio industry, only to discover the compact disc had been launched. And everybody said, "Oh, great Solomon error correction. How does that work?" I said, "I know how that works." It's just like in a hard drive. Mm-hmm. What about DSP? How does that work? Oh, it's but a computer, isn't it? All of a sudden, I knew about digital audio. Was that lucky or what? And I wrote this book some of you may have heard of. I knew I'd arrived as an author when I turned up to give a training course at the BBC in Wood Lane. Because I went into the next classroom to mine because I wanted some felt tip pens. You don't write with them, you sniff them. And in the next classroom, I found a 35mm slide projector angled up to shine at the right height by a couple of my textbooks under its feet. I knew at that point I'd arrived. I was lucky enough to be present in Eindhoven when the compact disc was launched. And it did quite well. It's still with us after all this time. That was 1982. So that's not bad as formats go. I think the reason it's endured is that it was good enough and it wasn't too good. Subsequent formats have either been not good enough, without naming mini-disc, or relying on too much hyperbole and not enough engineering, without mentioning super audio compact disc. So the CD served us very well. My CD player has served us very well. In fact, there's a story behind that because it's made in Glasgow by a company called Lynn. And when digital audio was developed, Lynn were a manufacturer of vinyl turntables. And they launched this fusillade of propaganda about what a load of crap digital audio was and how vinyl was wonderful and how you should buy their turntables. While secretly they were designing this. This might be the world's best CD player. Although the CD player itself is irrelevant, what matters is the digital to analog converter, which is in a separate box so they could sell it for more. Although having said that, it's actually quite good. Because unlike a lot of systems, the Lynn D2A is the source of the sampling rate block, and the transport is genlocked to it. So the DAC sends a clock to the transport. The transport then sends data back at that frequency. So the time-based stability of this thing is fantastic, and from a sonic standpoint, it's not there. So I love this thing. I've had it for donkey's years. And a couple of years ago, it broke down. The disc started skipping. Spindle bearings had worn out. And the disc was rocking, and the tracking couldn't follow it. I found a spindle motor on eBay, £5. And as you can see, as you can hear, it still works. So that's a story partly about the hypocrisy and nonsense, which is hi-fi. Hi-fi has played its part in halting the development of loudspeakers. The active loudspeaker is the last thing a hi-fi shop wants because it's got an amplifier in it. They can't sell you an amplifier. And when the amplifier's in it, what loudspeaker cables do you suppose it uses? I had a real problem building these speakers because you can't get conventional loudspeaker cable anymore. I had to build a machine to put the oxygen back in them. And another machine to squeeze the bullshit out. Seriously, actually it's very hard to be serious about hi-fi. But seriously, because hi-fi is based upon nonsense, because it's based upon belief structures, because it's become a replacement for religion, it can't make any progress. Progress is based on reality. Progress is based on how things are. You build something that doesn't work, you go, oh, I need to change that. Hi-fi has carried on making things that don't work since the launch of the compact disc. You know, the compact disc basically was the transparent sound source that every consumer had been waiting for, unless you're a hi-fi enthusiast, in which case it had to be improved. You know, maybe back in 1918, sound reproduction wasn't very good, and the ethic then was to improve it. Maybe in 1924, the ethic was still to improve it. Then along came vinyl disc, which is fairly good but not brilliant. The ethic again was to improve it. And then in 1982, along came the compact disc. And anybody with half a brain should have said, well, we can stop now and listen to the music. But no, you can't sell magazines like that. They had to carry on improving it. But, you know, when you've got sharper than the human hearing system, what's the point? It was the compact disc that got me into loudspeaker design. I thought, what's the point in spending all this time and effort with superb microphones, superb analog to digital converters, data recorders that don't make any errors, thanks to Mr. Reed and Mr. Solomon, good digital to analog converters. We can preserve the waveform from the microphone all the way down the chain. We need to smash it to bits in the loudspeaker. What's the point? So in fact, it was the compact disc that gave me the kick in the behind to do what I'd been meaning to do since I was a student at Southampton, to make a decent loudspeaker. Took a while, but here it is. My student days, and in fact the rest of my life, could not be complete without the works of Carole King. I think that's probably true of many people. So this is something from my formative years, 1971. Might just find James Taylor in there somewhere.
When you're down and troubled and you need some love and care, and nothing is going right. Your eyes.
She wasn't black, she was Jewish. Illustrates my point that prejudice is an alternative to thinking. Another singer who has been central to my life is Joni Mitchell. She, like myself, wasn't very well when she was young. And the story goes that she was bedridden and her bed looked out the window over a railroad track. She used to wave to the train drivers. About 30 years later, she met this guy who didn't know who she was. He said, "Where are you from?" And she said, "Oh, you never heard of the place I come from. It's Boondocksville, Canada." "Well, what's it called?" And she told him. "Oh," he said, "I used to drive a train through there." He said, "The only thing I can remember about this place is there was this girl who used to wave at me through the window." She said, "That was me." A small world, isn't it? So, my life wouldn't be complete without being able to listen to Joni. And, of course, right now, we can only listen to her through recordings because she had a stroke. She can't speak. This is a personal favourite of mine, personal favourite of Liza's, and this dates from 1971.
People to come nearer the front if they haven't done so, because I think it sounds better here than it does.
Yeah, he's encouraging people to come forward if you want to, and I have no problem with that.
Okay. sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave you, Carrie, but it's really not my home. My inner days of filthy, I've got beach tar on my feet, and I miss my clean linen and my fancy French clothes. Oh, Carrie, get out your cage.
I love this part when people start shining torches in the speakers. It's actually not magic. There really are parts that you can buy in there. One of the attributes of these loudspeakers is that they have an absurdly small enclosure for the low frequency units. And as you also know, that will increase the resonant frequency. But of course, that only applies to passive loudspeakers, which I don't believe in. Many years ago, I came across a circuit which enabled the resonant frequency of a woofer to be overridden in the frequency and in the phase domains so that you could make the woofer think it was in a much larger box than it was. I seem to remember the chap that designed it was called Linkwitz. But the bad news is I'm not using that circuit. I'm using another one. Not because the Linkwitz circuit doesn't work, but because the Linkwitz circuit is too clever. It does it all in one chip and everything's all tied up with everything else. So being a bit dumb, I've got a circuit that does stuff separately, so I can control the resonant frequency with one knob and I can control the Q factor with another knob. But the overall transfer function is exactly as the good man said. So that's how you get lots of LF out of a small box. Obviously the transducers have to be up to the job. A legacy woofer can't do it. A legacy woofer is a mass of stress concentrations and cone breakup disguised as a transducer. And if you want to make a diaphragm move at high speed, the last thing you want to do is to drive it with a small cone right in with a small coil right in the middle. What you should be doing is use a larger coil some distance out across the membrane, so the distance from the coil to the furthest point is reduced. It makes the thing stiffer. It's obvious. You know, why try to cross a swamp in stiletto heels when you can use a hovercraft? It's that simple. The majority of legacy loudspeakers use very small coils because the stress concentration, where most of the coil movement is used distorting the centre of the cone, and the perimeter of the cone doesn't do anything. So the coils in these woofers are surprisingly large, and they're not made out of copper, because copper is the last thing you want in a dynamic system. They don't put copper wiring in airliners because it's too heavy. They use aluminium because its conductivity to mass ratio is better. So why would you make a transducer with a copper coil in it if you're trying to get the thing to move properly? You know, you don't put a bag of cement in your car for fun. So let me close by playing you another one of my favourite tracks. This is not chosen for its sonic quality. It's not chosen for the skill of the performance. It's chosen for the lyric. This is Bruce Springsteen, but he didn't pay the electricity bill, so he's playing acoustic. And the lyric here just appeals to me, so listen to the words.
Eerie clarion, silver lining, every dog has a day, she said. Now don't say nothing if you don't have something nice to say. Tough how they get going when that going get tough, but feeling my best is never good. Now don't try for a home run, babe, if you can get the job done with a hit. Remember, a quitting man and a winning man quits. The sun don't shine on the sleeping dog's ass and on the rest of that stuff, but feel my. God gives you nothing but lemons, but makes some lemonade. The early bird catches the fucking one. Rome wasn't built that day. Now life's like a box of chocolates, you never know what you're gonna get. Stupid is and stupid does and all the rest of that shit. Come on, break, baby, come on, my. The sleep is no good enough.
As an audience of this Kalaipa deserves, I've tried to do my best. If I failed, there may be some time for some questions. Oh dear. Because lack of questions could mean one of two things. It could mean that everything I've said was so immediately understandable that there's no question, or it could be that everyone's so completely snowed they don't know what to say. I've got a question.
The speaker's clearly omnidirectional in the horizontal plane. What about the vertical plane? Does that matter less, or?
Well, I think you can probably guess from the fact that the top is made of solid metal that the vertical radiation is pretty negligible. I mean, there is some.
Whoa!
I shouldn't be here, should I?
No, I'll hand you over to the other side to stop that happening. Yeah. Sorry.
Loop gain exceeds one, you're in trouble. Yeah, the vertical radiation is suboptimal. And it only works because our ears are laterally displaced. If you're like a parrot and you go around with your head on one side, you might hear some problems. I'm sure that's why they do it, so they can discern verticality in sound. You look as though you were.
Yeah, I was just curious over your resonance control. We're using Stahl's ideas. Hmm? Eric Stahl also came up with a circuit to move resonances around.
Lots of people have come up with ideas to get over the fundamental resonance of a woofer. And the electronics is not the problem. If you equalize a legacy woofer to get rid of the resonance, you will drive it into non-linearity or you drive it into cone breakup. You cannot use a conventional woofer because the more you equalize it, the lower the level you can achieve. It becomes self-defeating. So you can only use powerful EQ if the drive units can handle it.
Yeah, I have. Well, a pretty obvious question that you probably would expect is about the time domain response. When you put a square wave, we used to do at HP this experiment, running a square wave through an all-pass filter, listening to it over headphones. And it was always interesting to see that you could change, of course, the wave shape completely, yet it still didn't seem to sound any different there. Unless you would increase the amplitude levels very high so that you got into the distortion in the ear itself, you know, the non-linearities in the ears, which you excite with a high crest factor of the square wave there, right? But before you get to that, the square wave can look any big shape there, and you switch back and forth, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. Yeah, we played a lot around with all pass filters, you know, doing those types of things.
I didn't know that question was going to be asked, but I know the answer. The answer is that the human ear works in two domains, which Werner Heisenberg predicted in connection with quantum mechanics. The human ear is a frequency analyzer, and therefore transformed duality applies to human hearing. At the time when the human ear is listening to a statistically stationary sound, like a square wave, it's not phase sensitive. And as you know, as you've seen, as we all know, you can mess around with the relative phase of the components of a square wave and you can't hear it. But that's when the ear is listening to a statistically stationary signal. The ear doesn't always do that. Because when the ear detects a new sound, it works in the time domain. Mm-hmm. However, briefly, the ear works in the time domain, and it is analyzing the time constants of sounds reaching it in order to determine where the sound comes from, which you can't do with a square wave or a sine wave, and how big the sound source is. And at the onset of a transient, the ear is phase sensitive. So although the experiments that show you can mess with the phase of a square wave are valid, you can't hear it, they're not valid for human hearing. Because at the onset of a sound, transient, the ear doesn't work that way. The ear works in the time domain. And we know it does because of the differences reaching our two ears. We can judge direction. The ear can only do that if it's working in the time domain. The ear judges how big things are by assessing the time constant. So we know that the transient we just heard was a pistol rather than a cannon. We know that that noise we heard outside was a truck driving over a bump in the road and not next door's kid tying his toy down the street with a piece of string. Yeah?
Makes sense.
He says it makes sense. So clearly we're both wrong. Question back there, just a minute. I'm not real fast these days.
As you explained to us, a lot of what you're saying is based on the time domain issue and the fact that we are hearing difference in arrival times. But correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that not happening above 3 kilohertz or 4 kilohertz? We've stopped being phase sensitive above this frequency. We actually measure level differences and not time arrival differences.
I think I can agree with you without retracting anything I've said. The majority of the improvement in phase linearity in these speakers is at relatively low frequencies. The phase correction of the woofer, the elimination of resonance, elimination of ports, elimination of bandpass architectures is all at low frequencies, but it all makes the sound more realistic. The accuracy of crossovers between woofer and mid-range is critical. And I agree, the higher the frequency you get, the less the ear can manage to extract time information because it's just getting too difficult. Our heads are too big.
These are bigger on the directional as the rest of the...
Yes.
Even though we're not time domain sensitive in the high frequencies,
we still don't. But the directivity is a different topic to the time domain precision. That the tweeter is omnidirectional, not to get the time domain correct, but to get the reverberant field correct. The fact that it happens to be time accurate is a bonus. Sam?
I was just going to ask. I was going to ask that one of the finest reference sound sources we have in the room is your voice. And could we have your voice through your loudspeakers?
I don't see why not.
Theoretically, we could. I mean, you're very kind. I never regarded my voice as being a reference way. although it's a very realistic reproduction of me. In principle, we could. In the past, we've done exactly that. In the past, we've done demonstrations with Liza playing her guitar and singing live, and we've recorded it and played it back through the speakers.
As a matter of fact, I recorded you right now. You have the right connector.
We can play you back.
All on here.
The audience doesn't deserve to hear me a second time. This is why I don't have a video recorder.
I'm not recording this.
I don't know if we can do that. Maybe in the morning we could do it. But the speakers can do it. Yeah. I've actually used them as sound reinforcement. We built a rig where the loudspeaker is vertically above Liza and the guitar. It's quite a strong rig.
No, this has a
and when we fade
mini
the
output
speaker up, it just got louder.
It'd be a recording of him through the speakers, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't be his voice.
Yeah, we record really. Yeah. It would not. It's
not material that I have heard before. Those recordings.
You haven't lived.
I've heard. various of the performance people, but not those particular tracks, right? But your voice, or some of our other voices we're familiar with around here, are really good reference signals, and I think would be ideal for displaying the qualities of your speakers. And I think interesting.
Yeah, in principle, we can do that. So we have done it in the past, and it does work. So maybe tomorrow morning we could try it. One trick that I played in Norway at an audio conference, I had speakers there, and they were in the bar, not doing anything. And I was chatting to the representative of a major microphone loudspeaker, whom I've known for some time. And he said, "Listen, let's play a trick." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, I got some of my best microphones here." He said, "On the other end of the hotel, they're playing a grand piano." I said, "Oh, that sounds like fun." So we got some of the best microphones on the planet hooked up to this grand piano at the other end of the hotel. And two bits of screen, twisted pair, coming to my speakers. And we just faded them up in the bar. Nobody took any notice, because they thought it was piano music. And it took about 15, 20 minutes before somebody turned around and said, "Where's the piano?" And then things started happening. So yes, we've done tricks like that to test realism. And it's good fun, as well as being rewarding.
We can do it in 2 minutes if you want, John.
Hmm?
You want to do it now?
You want to do it?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
sure. I'm told it can be done.
You'll sound like this afterwards, though.
I always sound like this. So, what do you want? You want some plugs? While that's happening, any other questions? Yeah, there's something back here.
Don't worry about the microphone, it's all right. So you built an excellent pair of speakers and crossover and all the other stuff you built.
And they were carried in beautifully.
Yes, yeah, that was fantastic. How can we take any of this and apply it to anything anyone else ever wants to make?
It depends how the problems are not technical. Problems are traditional. Investment, vested interests, prejudice, psychological. Problems are not technical. There's nothing, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing stopping making a million of those next week. It's just engineering. You know, they've got electronic components in there that are not rocket science. It's got like 20-year-old chips in there in the power amp. It's got 100-year-old resistors. It's got technical stuff like capacitors. It's got magnets and coils. There's nothing in there that you can make tomorrow. The reason that these are not in production is human, not technical.
Just curious as to why you didn't make them circular.
I didn't make them circular because it's too difficult for computer-operated sheet metal benders.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Want to know where to stick it?
I think I've got it.
Oh, he's got it. Yeah.
I think so. So this goes to that and it's self-contained, yes?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I should point out these speakers are not made of wood. Wood is a suboptimal material for loudspeakers because it's too thick. Imagine how much volume you lose because of the thickness of the wood in the speaker. These speakers are made out of steel, and they're made on a computerized sheet metal punch and bender. The forklift truck loads it with sheets of steel. Mm.
Sorry, just
keep talking. Something will happen.
Oh, okay. I'm apprehensive here.
I think you're coming out of your speakers now. Yes. You need to adjust the volume.
Do I need more level?
Yeah.
Oh, hello.
Where's the knob?
On your machine.
Is that?
No.
It's
on...
Mark's got the knob.
Mark's got the knob.
You want to rephrase that?
More
we say.
Am I coming out of my own speaker set?
You are.
Yes. Do I sound
That's
anything
right.
like?
You sound different, but then the system is equalised for a standard system. I could
try not
remove
to EQ
that.
Out.
Okay. So there's no EQ on that now.
Oh, how do I sound now?
More like yourself.
More like yourself.
I'm feeling more like myself.
Probably if you
I should get out of the way so yes. I'm not feeding back, shouldn't I?
Don't feed back
here.
At home.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah, you don't make loudspeakers out of wood.
That's quite good.
I mean, Jesus Christ could have made a traditional loudspeaker. Nail six pieces of wood together and put some commoditized rav units in there. And sell it for 10 times what it cost. But the thickness of wood is the last thing you want in a woofer because it means the speaker has to be a lot bigger. If you make the woofer enclosure out of steel, then it only needs to be a fraction of an inch thick and you gain a lot of volume behind the woofer. The resonant frequency goes down. Now, the other thing you can do is that by using a suitable substance inside the woofer enclosure, you can switch between isothermal and adiabatic conditions. And again, make the enclosure seem to be bigger than it actually is.
Yeah.
And we've done all those tricks. It's all in the textbooks. And do I sound anything like myself?
Yes, you do.
I try to.
Absolutely.
I mean, I could carry on talking complete nonsense so that you can listen. Well, I've been doing it all evening and nobody's noticed. But, we've done this trick before with reproducing live sound, with sound reinforcement or with recording things and then playing it back instantly. One of my favourite recollections was at an AES conference where we recorded Liza playing. We also recorded a lady playing an Irish harp, which is very transient rich. And at the end of the demonstration, this guy came up to me and he started looking at my kit. And I had this little widget that you connect to a laptop with a microphone input and an A to D and a D to A. He said, that runs at 96 kilohertz, doesn't it? I said, yeah. He said, well, you were running it at 96 kilohertz, weren't you? I said, no. He said, why not? Well, I said, because 44 kilohertz is perfectly adequate. Yeah, but why didn't you run it at 96 kilohertz? Because it could. I said, because it annoys idiots like you.
No, any more fire jokes?
Any more fire jokes? Oh, yeah, don't smoke in bed. The ashes you find between the sheets might be your own. Was that bad? Now, who else's voice do you know? Mr. Holland. You've been listening to him.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you say a few words so that people can hear what you really sound like?
Well, if I could think of what to say.
No.
No. Too close.
Yeah, well, no, it's,
I never make a performer.
No, it's more that John is, he might make them, but he is not a loudspeaker himself.
I tried to tell a joke in a lecture once, so I was putting out pictures of different types of microphones, and one of them was a vocal microphone. I found this nice picture of Mick Jagger almost eating the microphone because I was trying to explain what the pop shield was for. And one of the things is to catch whatever comes out of the singer's mouth. And not very pleasant, I know.
I like the tone of this.
So I put this picture of Mick Jagger almost eating the microphone, and I said, that's Mick Jagger. And nobody laughed.
Yes, on that topic, a lot of sound engineers use two microphones to record pop stars. The first microphone is for the performer to eat, and the one that's actually connected is about half a meter further away.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I can do it. Close the door. Take the radio mic.
Oh, right. I'll play you a very famous bass solo. I hope I'll do it correctly.
Keep going, Sam.
Take the mic. The door.
Further.
Play it again, Sam. This one's actually producing a phantom, quite interesting, you know, a phantom sort between.
Yes.
So what do you think? Did it sound like my double bass?
What do you think, guys?
I know Ziegler has one more question for you. We're all here together.
The question that I have is, do you show plans on how to build these speakers? Do it yourself?
Well, he could tell you, but then he'd have to shoot you.
Am I on? Yeah. These speakers are designed using an advanced technology that my friends call WattoCAD.
WattoCAD.
It consists of me dreaming these things up in my head, telling a very good CAD entry person that I know how to convert them into actual physical pieces. I have to admit that I designed the power supply, I designed the crossover, I designed the power amplifiers, I designed the box. But this is the first loudspeaker I made where I didn't design all the drive units as well. The drive units are commercially available, I'd be pleased to know that the HF unit is made in Germany by Josef Mayer. But the answer is, if you wanted to build these yourself, then just ask. There's nothing about these speakers that can't be reproduced. You know, the enclosures are made by computer, by robot. You just put a ton of sheet metal in with a forklift truck by loading a photocopier. And this thing knocks hell out of the metal and produces an enclosure just like that. And they're all exactly the same within a tenth of a millimeter. But the heat sink is NC machined by a company that builds aeroplanes. And again, that's all dead accurate. They just fit. And the only traditional part is the wood. The wood trim. That's made by an antique furniture restoration company, which is like a kilometre from my house. So there's nothing in there that you can't make. These were made in my house.
How heavy are they?
I don't know, just a minute.
Well, this guy
here can say. Too heavy for your hand luggage.
They're too heavy for me, but they're light for him.
About 25 kilos.
25 kilos.
Yeah, 20, 25 kilos. Mm-hmm. I have bigger ones. They're really heavy. But when you consider that this contains the power supply, the amplifiers, one amplifier per drive unit, crossovers, heat sink, everything is all in there. You just apply power and signal and off it comes.
What kind of amplifier is it?
It's a conventional IC-based linear power amp, which has been available for a long time, built by National Semiconductor. And these devices, the sound quality is limited entirely by circuit board layout. The chips themselves are practically flawless.
LM3886.
You got it. He knows. I should point out that the circuit design in here is fanatical. Every single device that needs to be earthed has its own circuit board track going back to ground. So the circuit board looks like a spider. So there's very little possibility for intermodulation or cross-coupling between signals. If you're into precision analog computing, then you know all of that. But nowadays everything is digital, so a lot of people don't know it. But laying out the crossover was extremely time-consuming, because a lot of printed circuit design software is based on connectivity. Yeah. You put the circuit in, and it says, well, I've done it. That's connected to this is connected to that. So, yeah, but that wire goes around the houses. Who knows that? Oh, well, it's still connected, isn't it? So if you let an auto-printed circuit design software loose on a piece of audio circuitry, what you'll get is rubbish. And you've actually got to redesign it afterwards. In some cases, I've actually laid analog circuitry out manually, because there's a computerized system made too big a mess of it.
Yeah.
But if you do all of that, you can actually get some astonishing quality out of commercially available chips. It's like humor, it's the way you do it. Well, I'm really right on the verge of exhaustion here.
Thank you, John.
Which is probably a good sign. It must be even worse. So, if I may hand back to our esteemed chairman. And thank you for being a wonderful audience.
Thank you, John.
this presentation. The poem that I read, the last time that this poem was read at this conference was when Robin read the same poem. And that was the last time that John.
Oh.
So we reckon it didn't really happen. It was just a bit of aliasing.
Stratford, yes.
Okay, I think I've just about run out of things to say, so enjoy the rest of your evening.